Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Insane in the membrane.
Morning, Ed.
Morning.
Oh, man, I tell you what, it's just the future is supposed to be, this technology is supposed to be aiding us and making our lives better. But just a simple logging on.
I think it's not aiding us, it's aging us is what it's doing. It's like, what is happening? It's honestly, I wanted to tell you what I could see, but actually all I needed to do was restart everything, pretty much like anything in life.
Just switch it off and switch it on again. Oh, man. I know what you mean. This is what happens. You remember when you were younger and like your nan or somebody would be dealing with some kind of technology and then they're going like, oh, I don't know how it works. And you're going, oh, you're so old. God, give it here. And now we're that, like you've just said, it's like, oh,
I'm really worried about that because I do know that, you know, that feeling where you obviously are helping someone who isn't as quite technology efficient. You think, oh, I'm always going to keep with the times. I'm always going to be with it. But even there are now nuances with social media that are cropping up and your brain doesn't almost have the power to deal with it. You know, you look at all the things like on Instagram and all the different things you can do on it now. And people are sort of embracing all these different ways of doing things. You know, it was before we were like, well, I remember when you just did a post and it was just some text and it was on Facebook. And like now I can feel it creeping in.
Yeah. It's just little things like I noticed on Instagram, they've swapped they swap the button around and now it threads is the first one. So you'll end up, you go to put something up and then it will send you to threads and you're going, I don't want to do that.
They've done that for people like you and me who are just going to click it by mistake and then maybe think we'll do something on threads.
Yeah. And then what happens is you click on it and you go, what's this? Oh, threads. I forgot that was still a thing. It's just so many. So a friend of mine, Alistair Barry, comedian, colleague of ours, he sent me a link to Blue Sky, which is another app that a lot of the journalists use. And you're like, yeah, but I'm having trouble keeping up with all these things. It's like a day now where you're just posting stuff.
Yeah. Blue Sky's another sort of, what, Twitter-esque app, is it?
Yeah, it's less about fighting and it's more about, it's like there are better red people on there, it seems.
Right, okay. But you're right, there's only so much space in your life for so many apps and social media stuff. But it's basically, they're like friends. There's only so many you can have.
Yeah. And just because you can't keep up with them all, you're just like, oh shit, yeah. I haven't spoken to that friend for a while. I need to, and then you get into your own head. Oh, it's been too long now. Maybe we're not friends anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just like, you know, maybe it's time that leave Friends United where it is, you know, just...
not ununited, whatever it is. What's the opposite of reunited?
Disunited?
Disunited?
I feel like I should know. Non-union? Mal-union? Mal-union is a very medical term, so I'll stick with mal-union.
Yeah. Mal-union, that sounds...
Mal-union's a poor union. I mean, mal-union's a union, but not a good union, so...
Oh, I see. It sounds like something's come loose, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sounds very orthopedic, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, your feet are now, you're very malunioned. But why don't you, I mean, you're an anaesthetist. Do you ever feel like just anaesthetizing yourself? Just going, do you know what, I'll just switch off for a couple of hours.
I think this is a really timely appearance on your podcast, because if you remember last week, we were meant to be doing this recording.
Yes.
And I just had one of those periods where lots of things started adding up and it was just pandemonium in the end. So as an anaesthetist in like, as a registrar, you're still a junior doctor, so you're still moving around different specialties. So I spent a few months in, neuro anaesthesia, brain surgery, then moving on to cardiac, then moving on to another one. And I just moved to another one as well. So at that point, you're getting to grips with a new environment, new part of hospital, new colleagues, new senior colleagues, consultants, people you want to impress. And it's a massive cognitive overload trying to get all that in. And people show you around. But you know when people show you around, like you go to a hotel and say, oh, do you want to see where the swimming pool is and everything? And you go around, you're like, oh, yeah. And then you have no idea where they just took you. And it takes you a couple of days to kind of, it's a bit like that. I always describe it when you start working in a new department in a hospital. It's like working in a supermarket you've never worked in before, but you're expected to know where everything is. So there's this constant phase of like, oh, yes, everything. And I just had one of those days where everything just felt like a calamity. You know, everything just felt like, oh, God, everything's so difficult. And it went on. And then I found out, because the other thing is we've done some massive life changing things in the last while. So I got engaged and then married. Oh, and then we, thank you. Yeah. And then we got a house and then we moved into the house and then we're having loads of stuff done. And so then it turned out that after that late night, we then were having just by the last minute that carpet people were coming. We're like, oh my goodness, it's freezing. We need the carpet sort of thing. So suddenly there's going to be loads of banging with them, like knocking. So I was like, right, that. And then just to top everything off, we got a new puppy as well. Not yesterday, that day, God. But we've had one, yeah. And the puppy had just had, got really sick and just poo everywhere, essentially. So it was like the puppy had just was the final straw.
Yeah.
Everything. So it was like there was only so much your brain and your body could take in at that point. And at that point, I was like, yes, an anaesthetic would be very nice indeed.
Well, I was happy I could offer some in the way of like, hey, let's just do this next week. At the end of the day, I love this podcast. I love doing this podcast. But if there's other things going on, we can shift things around. It's not, we'll always get there. It's always fine. I know what you mean. There's a few times I'll get ready to do this and I'm all set up and ready. Like I'll set up the night before, I'm ready to go. And it's like everybody in the world goes, oh, Rich is about to do something. Hey, let's throw things at him. And you're going, why are you? And like the other day, there was like, I don't know how many people turned up at the door, but you're like, who turns up at the door? Who does that now? Unless you're a delivery driver.
Yeah, exactly. Who ordered this Amazon? Oh, I did. Right, okay.
You forget.
It's like you blame everyone else, but it's yourself. That's what you used to. Well, there was a period last week, so it was bang on the time I think we were meant to recording. And as I said, carpet poo went. So there was loads of banging and I was clearing up poo as well. And I just thought, you know what? This actually probably would have made a really good episode visually, if nothing else.
Just this slapstick kind of stuff going on around
Honestly, I want to carry on with the recording. Just scooping up feces whilst there's lots of knocking going on.
Rolls of carpet whirling around. I've never spoken to an anaesthetist. How do you say it? Anaesthetist. I thought I'd nailed it.
Not many people do get to speak to them. It's too late after you've met them. They're suddenly asleep. That's how we like to roll. Unless you're in maternity, obviously, and you're having a baby, then you'll hopefully stay awake for the baby being delivered. So,
do you know what this is? So our baby is 2 weeks old.
Oh, and, wow! Congratulations! Yeah,
thank you. And the anaesthetist then was excellent. He was so chilled, and because they found out that we were comedians, my wife and I. And so they were effing and jeffing in the thing. And it was so funny. It was the best delivery room I've ever been in. It was so good.
Better than any comedy clubs, you mean?
It was really fun. Everyone was up for it. we had a playlist that we chose, that we put together, and they were just cracking jokes, and it was such a chilled vibe because my wife was really nervous.
Brilliant.
Because it's her first kid, and we were having a C-section, so you know she was a bit nervous, and it was excellent. It was so funny. It was great. It was really great.
And when it goes well, it's really a lovely experience, and it's a case of, you know, things don't look great. You act quickly and you move quickly and you try to keep everyone calm, because part of you know, the whole process is trying to keep people sort of calm. It's a joyful experience. It's one of the few things in medicine where it's something joyful. You're coming in, you're going to go out with an extra person, and that's such a joyful thing. So actually getting mother and a baby together as soon as possible, all those kind of things, it makes a huge difference. So you have to move very quickly, and you want to keep that atmosphere if it's possible. Yeah. But as a result, it can be quite, you know, sort of challenging as well.
I haven't had a kid in, the last time I had children was 26 years ago. So it's all completely different now. And they were just a great bunch of people. They were really nice. And then when the baby came out, and my friends had said, don't look around the curtain. And of course I had to have a look, and it was like, oh my God, I'll never unsee that. But they were really, and then they were like, right, we're going to sort mum out. So yeah, here's the baby. And then they took me into this other, like the recovery room, and they sat me under this big oven, and then they were just dealing with Kate, and it was just really nice. You know, I think because we watch hospital dramas, and everyone's, you know, in the OR, and everyone's like, oh my God, it's, and you're just like, oh my God, hospitals seem stressful. Is it stressful?
I think it is stressful. There's times when, like you've described, you can have something that's straightforward. You might have, well, it's an elective cesarean section, so it's all planned. There's no rush. We can take time. We can stop. There's no threat to mother or baby. So, and it's really nice and, you know, a joyful experience. But on the other extreme, you know, if there's a problem for mum or baby, and it, you know, it's the other end, and it's a category one cesarean section, you've got to move fast. That's where you have a little bit of, you know, a situation awareness. You want to keep people as calm as possible. There is a bit of poker face because you wanted to do things quickly, but also in a way that's calm and processed. So you flip between very quickly. And in something like maternity, it moves on very quickly because once mum's delivered and is okay and then taken over to recovery, there's always another baby coming. There's always another.
Yeah.
There's a whole sort of belt of children coming along, that, you know, and you've got to go back next. It's like the generation game, but you've got to do every single one.
Well, because it was an elective, so they were saying, right, so get to the hospital for 7 in the morning, and then we'll put you in a room, and then we'll let you know when it's going to happen. So yeah, it's like you've taken a number at the deli, and then they go, yeah, but then there might be someone that comes in who needs emergency meat. So you might get, your number might get pushed along a bit. So it came in, and there was a couple of emergencies. So we had to wait. So it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon by the time we were seen. But then they were sorting Kate out, gave me the baby. And then they went, right, we need to get through this. Someone's coming in with triplets. And we were like, what? What? Just, yeah, it was like this conveyor belt of people. But
that's the word I was looking for before, conveyor belt. I couldn't think what conveyor was. And how long was the whole process, do you think?
Not long. Compared to the first child I ever had, she was having contractions on the one morning, and then nothing happened. So I went home, and then they induced her the next day, and then she was in labour for most of the day, and then in the evening he was born, and then it took a couple of days. Whereas this was kind of right. The elected cesarean is on this day. We'll have it done by this time. Yeah. And then by sort of 7, 8 o'clock in the evening, you're up on the ward, and you're just chilling. And
I mean, that's the getting your head together. Yeah, that's a great, great thing to, great way to see it happen, because as I said, with emergencies, you know, they categorize them. So if it's a, this is a category one, we need to go now, it's baby out within 30 minutes. So, you know, that's a, such a, you think about it, such a short amount of time to go from the room to the theater and then within a couple of minutes having baby as well.
Your head must be spinning at that point, whereas we were kind of, like I say, very chilled, got into it. I will say this, and I've said this a few times, when I looked round and they were, and then because the baby was quite high up, and I looked round, honestly, they were really, I'm not surprised that you're numb from like the chin down. Because they were really, really, like they were trying to get a sofa through a cat flap. They were really going for it. And you're like, what is going on?
Yeah. So it's, it, we don't take, it doesn't take away the sort of rummaging, tugging, pulling, but it takes away the pain. But it's, it, I think for some people, it's difficult to get your head around that that could be the case, that you could be awake, you can be pain-free, you can still feel some things going on, but you're comfortable as well. And like you said, you'll, you might see what's going on, you're like, oh my goodness, how is this, how is this working? What is this black magic that was going on?
I think that's what I hear. What is that, what is anesthetic, like what does it do? I've never asked this before. Like, was it, does it shut down the pain receptors or whatever it is? What does it do?
Yes, yeah, so it depends where you're putting the anesthetic. So if we were giving a general anesthetic, we give drugs into a vein, or we give gas, and that makes, you know, that renders you unconscious essentially, and we may use muscle relaxants, things like that. With this is in that particular way, that is a local anesthetic is what we're using. So have you ever had a local anesthetic in the skin or something like that to numb an area? It's a similar kind of it's a similar kind of drug we would use with some painkillers as well, and we go to different spaces. So if you, in people joke in maternity and anesthetics, well, you're only going to do like one of three things, and that's either a spinal anesthetic, an epidural, or you're going to do a general anesthetic. So general anesthetic would be, you know, hopefully avoidable because you want baby and mum to be awake, sort of thing. So that would be sort of an extreme if there was a problem, something else. A spinal, which is probably what you had if you had a elective caesarean, so you got a needle in the back, some local anesthetic there, and then put local anesthetic into the space where you've got fluid surrounding the brain, the CSF, and that goes in and that works. You might have seen it worked really quickly, like within a couple of minutes, and then suddenly you don't move your legs as much, and it just the drugs there, the local anesthetic, just block those routes, and then that basically renders it pain-free. Now with an epidural, you go into a space that's slightly closer to you, so you don't go as far. And it's a space that you fill up with local anesthetic. So it doesn't have quite the same onset. It's slower, but it will get there. So it's really, because people say, oh, you only got three things you're going to do. But the choices you make between doing those things in an emerging situation, obviously, you know, it's huge. They're quite weighted, but with an elective and doing it like that, it's quite good fun.
Yeah. So local is just kind of like areas. And then, but general is the whole thing.
Yeah, so local, we call it regional anaesthesia. So yeah, local would be anything. So if someone was having, you know, like hip surgery, you could do a local anaesthetic as well, like a spinal or something, and that would kind of numb the area from a certain place. So with an obstetric, you know, with having a baby, you obviously want to numb it down from where they're going to be doing anything up there. So that's the level you want to get it to, essentially. But with a general anaesthetic, you're putting drugs into the vein, not into sort of certain areas. So that your vein is blood, you know, going around the entire body. So the anaesthetic will go into the brain and then make people unconscious. So that's what people think of when they think of anaesthetics.
Yes.
They don't think about the stuff like in maternity and stuff. So when we're there. So, but then this is the thing. You find that we're all over the place. We're ubiquitous. So we're in intensive care. Mm. We are in pain medicine as well. We're helping children have scans and dealing with all different extremes of ages too. So there's loads of different things with anaesthetics. Hence why you do lots of training in different areas with it.
Right. And when you've done your training and you come out the other side, you've got all your qualifications, do you then specialize in certain areas, or do you just, you're just an anaesthetist and you do it all?
I think it's like when you start medicine, there's this, I described this the other day, where one of the best days in medicine is like your first day at medical school. Cause like, you're like, oh, well, I'm here and there's so much to know, but I don't need to know it now. And then every day onwards, it's just sort of like, oh my God, there's so much I need to know. And of course, like it's impossible for you to know everything in medicine. So that's why you do have specialists. So like, you know, I always say like, you know, like a heart surgeon doesn't know anything about skin diseases, just like an orthopedic surgeon doesn't know anything. So
God,
you specialize in anesthetics in certain things. So yeah, you might become in maternity, or you might do brain surgery, or you might do heart surgery, and you'll do one of those things and maybe keep your wings spread with a couple of other things. But generally you'll have one or two things you end up doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I see. So this is great. I've never been able to speak. I've never spoken to anyone before about this. This is wonderful. When you...
You want the drugs. That's what it is, isn't it? It's what's the drugs.
Anything to numb the pain, man.
Exactly, yeah. we use cocaine as well.
What?
Like people, yeah, I know. We use cocaine, fentanyl. It's all the cool stuff we end up using.
Is that just to get you through a shift?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just when there's not any coffee left.
I'll just use a bit of this. Because there is a lot of stress.
Stuff.
There's a lot of pressure to not just... There's so much you need to know, as you've just said, when you're getting your qualifications. And then when you finally get your qualifications, you come out the other side. Then there's the pressure. There's like bureaucracy and red tape and underfunding and things like that. I mean, we won't go into it because I want you to keep your job, but you know, it must be hard. There is so much pressure on nurses and doctors at the minute.
Yeah, there is a lot of that, and it's frustrating when, you know, operations get cancelled because there's not space or it's, you know, things are really busy. I think you get more of that when you, like you said, when you become a consultant, you get involved with the management.
Mm.
So it does add more admin to you. It's just an ongoing thing. I think sometimes you forget we've got a huge organisation in the NHS and, you know, lots of management, lots of things. So it's inevitable, like you're going to have this. So, it takes, I think particularly over the last decade or so, things have, you know, got worse, and it does feel like we need a sort of fresh sort of set of eyes on it.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. I think that's it. It's become such a mess. I think with everything, with the NHS, with politics in general, it's become such a... It's all just an absolute mess. It's like it all needs to be kind of like swept up to one side, and then we're like, we pick out the bits and go, right, let's rebuild this again. You know what I mean? It must be so hard.
Well, yeah, it's almost like a bald NHS, and someone can approach it from their specialty and they'll always find something with it. So for instance, with anaesthetics, so to be an anaesthetist at the moment, what you do is you apply, you do medical school 5 years, then you do 2 years of your first two doctors training, and then you apply for anaesthetics. And you might say, well, Ed, you've applied for anaesthetics, you've got in, that's the end of it. No, you do 3 years of anaesthetics, right? So bear in mind, you've done 5, 2 with another 3, that's 10 years. Then you have to apply again for your next stage of training. Now, when I applied, there was, I think it was something like 1,200 people applied, roughly, and they gave about 300 places.
Oh my God.
You've got like, you know, yes, 700 or 800 people who have chosen to pursue this career, who've then kind of just been left out in the cold. And then they say, oh, we haven't got enough doctors.
Yeah.
But that's all on sort of the government deciding how many training places. So they've created a bottleneck, yet there's still plenty of people who want to come and train. So that's just me telling you from my side. And then you could pick another specialty or another part of it, whether it's, you know, nursing or physio, or, you know, you'll find things like this. And that's the frustrating thing. There's all these lots of things that don't make sense in it.
The first time that you gave someone an anaesthetic, how did you feel? What was happening?
I thought they were faking it. Because the thing is, like, you know, someone goes from talking to you and then they basically just don't. And you're like, hello, hello. And then there's a test you can do where you just sort of touch the eyelashes to see if there's any reaction.
Mm.
And there was no reaction. I was like, oh my goodness, yeah, it is. And then the real giveaway that they're not faking it is they're not breathing. And so that's the one where you're like, oh, right, okay. But it's scary because it's the opposite of what everything else you do. So when I started anaesthetic, someone told me it's like going back to medical school again, because you kind of relearn everything from a different perspective. So if you went to your GP and they made you unconscious and paralyzed you, that would generally be frowned upon. But then that is our day job. So when doing things the opposite of what was, so this is what I wrote all this stuff down.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh my God, this is fascinating. Which obviously then I put in the book because it was so fascinating to me at that time. You know, when something's so fascinating to you and you do it again and again and again, it gradually becomes less fascinating.
Yes.
So I remember just writing down these things and I look back and, because you asked me, you know, what was it like? And I do remember writing down just saying, I thought they were faking it because it just looked like it. It just looked like it to me.
Yeah.
And so you learn so much in that first period about the human body as well. I mean, it's, you know, seeing people not breathe for their period of time is terrifying at the start, but then you're like, oh, it's fine.
Just get used to it. Is it, were you relieved when they came back round? You're like, oh, that was all right. That went well.
Yeah, well, exactly. He's like, you're right. You're right. Good. Yeah.
That
was close.
Lost you there for a minute, mate. There's this lovely story of Dawn French when she told on Graham Norton, I think, or somewhere. And when she was having an operation and as she was drifting off, and she said, take good care of me. I'm a national treasure.
And did they say anything?
I don't know. But I just thought it was a nice story. They just kind of, you know, just take care of me. I'm a national treasure. I know my wife, when she had an appendicitis really badly, and, you know, it was touch and go for a bit whether she was going to come through when they were putting her under. And then she woke up. And she just went, have I got a tube? Have you ever had anyone say anything that's like just cracked you up? Is there anything that you've gone, oh my God? And you have to try and keep a straight face.
I think, I can't remember. I said something to an anaesthetist when I was going under and it made everyone laugh. I was only like 5 years old or something. But it was something about the anaesthetists themselves. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I did remember feeling grateful that I woke up afterwards. Well, I was always being a cheeky kid. But, I mean, obviously, it's a bit, you know, you lose inhibitions because we're obviously giving drugs and things like that. So people may say one or two things. We always describe it. Some of the drugs we give, we describe it. If you ever had a couple of glasses of wine, they'll say, yes, go, well, we're about to give you something that feels quite similar to that.
Yeah.
So you'll get people go, well, this is pretty, yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it? Like, you know, and then you'll give the rest of the anaesthetic. So, I think the most amazing thing I find is that the people say is when they wake up and they're immediately thankful. So, like, you're just, the one second asleep and they're just like, you're done. Oh, thanks so much. Thanks. You know, like they've just had a haircut or something. It's just, you know, it's just so matter of fact. And they have no idea what they've just been through. And I was like, no, honestly, thank you. Like, and then you think stuff, are they going to remember? Thank you. But they're just so grateful. It's
Thing. Just start showing them a mirror. There you go. What do you think? Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thank you. I do remember when I had kidney stones about 10 or so years ago. And I remember getting taken to the hospital. I didn't know what it was, and my partner at the time drove me to the hospital, and then I ended up hyperventilating because the pain was so bad, and then I started to buckle in, and I was all bent up, and I'm on the, they put me on the bed, and I'm just kind of, you know, I didn't know what was happening, and then I heard the guy say, he said to the nurse, we're going to have to give him an antispastic injection, and I, because when he said that, I looked at my then partner and I went, did he? And she just went, don't. And I started laughing. I know you shouldn't. I don't think he meant, and it's like a, I can't remember what it's actually called. It used to be called that. It's like anti.
So you were having a spasm, were you?
I was spasming. So I was all locked up. So, and he said, we're going to have to give him an antispastic injection.
So probably meant some benzodiazepine or something like that then.
Yeah.
Just kind of, but.
Yeah. And I just laughed, even though I was in my bent up state. And he said that. And I'm like, what? And then my wife went, don't. And I went, and I just started laughing. Because it was just like, it was just so out of the blue. I know what he meant. And it probably what used to be called that. But yeah.
I said antispasmodic, Something like that, maybe.
Oh, maybe, no, he said I'm sure he said antispastic.
I've never heard that.
And it just made me laugh.
Are you sure they were a doctor? Because yeah, I mean, yeah, there's lots of fakery going on. You just need to be. I mean, the thing is, you go into maternity and you're a dad, as you were saying. I bet you did. You put on scrubs.
I did.
Yeah, you put on scrubs. You could have just walked around and just said, "Yeah, look, I'm one of the doctors." So, and you're going, "Oh, really?"
I thought it was weird. We were actually in the car park. Just this dude walking around giving people injections. yeah, I did have scrubs on, and yeah, it did. It was. I did. I said to my wife, I was going, look, I'm going to say scalpel.
Yeah, you should moonlight as a surgeon. That's what you should do, definitely. It's like, yeah.
God. Just walking around, just signing things. Yeah, 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 fine. Yeah, signing people's notes. Yeah, yeah, that's fine.
So technically, you can prescribe on anything. You could get a serviette or a piece of toilet paper or something, and you could write, you know, like sort of whatever drug you want to, then a doctor signs it, and that's technically a prescription you can take in. They would generally kind of review that, but it's you can do that. I don't know if it goes so far as body parts that you could sign someone's arm, you know, sort of 50 tramadol or something like that, and then you take that. Yeah, yeah, look, it says here, you know, got it tattooed. Yeah. But I did always think, like, especially because, you know, and I had the book come out and stuff, people wanted you to sign books and stuff. But I was always thought, you know, what if they write, like, you know, some tramadol above it and then take that to a pharmacist?
Yeah.
Prescribed it, you know.
Mate, yeah, just write anything. This isn't, are you sure? This is your own mother. Yeah, but look, he's written on her, see?
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So how long have you been doing comedy for?
So I started, I had such a huge love for comedy when I was younger. My brother used to take me when I was a kid to, so from Nottingham, so he used to go to Just the Tonic in Nottingham.
Oh, yeah.
He used to sneak me in and stuff. And then what happened was I went to med school and I did a couple of shows, like just sort of, you know, sort of student-y shows. And then when I got to med school, I tried to do as much, but I was up in Aberdeen. So I was coming down to like the stand doing like spots there and things like that. And then I came down in 2016 to back to the UK, and I then had a proper go at being able to do it, because it was in, yeah, Aberdeen's lovely, but it's like 2 hours away from anywhere else sort of thing. So, yes, you know, there wasn't as much going on at that time. So, but the thing was, at that time, when I was at med school, I had a gig down south, and I asked if I could go just have a day off. And they said, called me into the office, and I thought they were going to say, oh, it's great, because they like you to do all the extracurricular activities and all these things. And they called me into the office, and basically I got an absolute rollicking for wanting to take a day off to go and do a comedy gig. And I was like, oh, right. Oh, okay. Wow. So they were very against it, very, very against it. And so when I came down, I was doing that first 2 years as doctor, and I thought, I can't mention it, because if people know, you know, they're going to. So I was moonlighting. I was doing like a gig and then a night shift. And
oh, wow.
I was doing all these, like, trying to fit in as much as possible. And then what happened was, in 2016, I got, it was the Leicester Mercury I got nominated for. So that's kind of when things started to take, and I stopped like pretending to hide it. And it was one of the consultants had seen something on about me or CV, and he accosted me. I thought, oh no, I'm gonna get absolutely rocked again. And he just said, oh, why didn't I know about this? Why didn't you tell me? You know, I play in a band and stuff. And
oh,
I was
wow.
like, oh, right. Well, I thought it wasn't frowned upon. He said, no, I'd much rather work with someone that I knew did other things than just medicine. But I really feel that I was in between a time, you know, a time where it wasn't sort of seen that you could do other things in medicine. You dedicate your entire life to it and stuff. Whereas like now I think they see there's been such a huge burnout, and you know, they want to kind of encourage people to maintain a work-life balance and they're giving sort of flexible training. Because, you know, full-time in the NHS is 48 hours for a doctor. So right. you go part-time, you know, some people that's 40 hours. That's still full-time in the other part, in the rest of the world. So it was really that moment when they said, you know, why haven't you told me about it? I suddenly thought, oh, I can be open about it. So then I started doing stuff. Then I went to the Fringe, took up a show, and then I did, started doing other things as well. So it was really from that moment. It went up from there.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. See, isn't it funny? It just takes one person to go, wait, listen, we don't, and then just for a couple of years now, you were just creeping around and it's such a shame.
There was a gig it wasn't too far away from where I was working. And it was the first time I turned up to this gig. So, you know, when you just starting out, you obviously just wanted to kind of get as much as possible. And there were three people in the audience. And it turned out that all three were doctors that I worked with. They had no idea I did this. And I just saw them from behind. And then I had to say to the promoter, I said, I can't do it. I can't do it. And it didn't matter because they had like 12 acts on or something like that. And he was like, that's absolutely fine if you want to. But I was just thinking, oh my goodness, you know. Done it then. But all that pressure. But I say, you know, I've juggled both, but a lot of people ask, oh, you know, would you choose one or the other? But for me, it really is that they both balance each other out, and I miss one and the other if I'm not doing this. So, and I say this quite frequently, like, comedy makes me a better doctor anyway.
Yeah.
You know, definitely in terms of, you know, you think of the things you're dealing with, you know, pressurized situations, communication, building rapport with people, you know, all that kind of thing builds in. And I definitely noticed it. And of course, when, you know, a couple of years ago when we all kind of, you know, couldn't do a gig, I certainly felt that as well, you know, that because it was almost it was a balance of me that had gone. And even now I've started to just dice a few things down because I've got like another anesthetics exam, and even then I can feel it inside me, you know, it's just there's an imbalance.
it's the thing is with comedy, once you've done it once, and I said this before, you always know whether you want to do it again. For whether it's gone good or bad, it's just a switch that gets flicked, and then it becomes. Even when I'm not thinking about comedy, when I'm doing something else, there's a bit of my brain that's just collecting and thinking up. It's like comedy exists within me now.
Yeah,
and while I'm doing something else, you know, it's a funny thing.
But it's also the things you never question. Like I look back now, and the things you did. Like I remember driving from Aberdeen to Manchester, which is what, 6 hours for a competition gig. And about halfway there, I suddenly thought to myself, if this doesn't go well, I've done 12 hours round trip. No pay. You might get through, but it's no pay. And it's like, wow, that is, but it never even occurred to me what it was going. All the gigs that you would do where you might get a bit of money, but it would never cover the cost of any travel. You know, you're putting yourself out there. And I think that's a sign when you're doing those things and you don't even question it, and you know there's a bigger picture in your head. I think that's, you know, when you're like, okay, I think I've got the bug.
Yeah, it is that. It's that. Yeah, I'm going to Leeds for a day, just up, like you say, 5 hours in the car, 20 minutes on stage, back in the car. And you just go, yeah, that's just what 20, I do.
25 quid.
25 quid. So it's not even, what is that? It's not even that. A penny a mile? I don't know. No, it's not even a penny a mile. It's like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous what we do. But why medicine? What got you into medicine?
I think I really, like, the thing I really loved was, so I did biology before. So I didn't go straight into medicine, and I loved and still do love Parasite. Like, I love
them. Oh, really?
And yeah, because the thing is, when you look at like infections or diseases and stuff, and you know, like viruses or bacteria, they're all the same. They all look the same, you know, microscope and all that kind of thing. But parasites are like a world of monsters.
Yes.
And they all look different. So you've got like ticks, you've got worms, you've got, you know, other stuff like bed bugs, or you've got malaria, which is like protozoa. So it was fascinating. And then also it's a real practical sort of hands-on being able to look at stuff. So I went to the London School of Tropical Medicine, and which was like super cool, like doing, you know, in this lab and like looking at things. So at that point, you know, someone could give me a blood sample, I could look down it and then tell you what, not just that it was malaria, but what kind of malaria it was.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, this is cool. I mean, I've lost all those skills, so I haven't done it for a while. But anyway, the point was I could have done it. part of that, I went to China as a project looking at worms in children. And so I did a project which I would say wouldn't have got off the ground in the UK, which was going to schools asking children to give me portions of poo in little boxes, and then I would take them away and I'd look at them under a microscope. And I don't know why, but I just don't feel that would have taken off in the UK. But
no,
I went to I went to these two different districts and collected them from the schools. And obviously I didn't speak the language, so I had to kind of ask the teachers to translate, who were just side-eyeing me like, who's this weird foreigner coming in collecting shit? And then we'd store it in just a fridge, just a normal fridge, which the other lab workers there would just put their lunch in next to, which always fascinates me as well. So space was a premium there. So I then spent days and days looking under the microscope. And one region was like a city region, didn't have any worms in or any problem. But then the rural one did. And then so obviously like wrote this up. And obviously the process after that is about treatment. And then you go on from that. And I realized that it was great doing what I did, but you know, I really was interested in the sort of diagnosis and then the treating side of things as well. And that was a stretch beyond what I was doing. And I was actually working in London at the Tropical Medicine alongside some doctors as well who were doing the course too. So I was like, wow, this is fascinating. Maybe I'll look into it. So then I started looking into it, had a little bit of work experience, and then just never looked back from that moment, really. I was just like, yeah, this is it.
Wow. What is it about parasites that is it just because it's they're actual creatures and things, and they say a world of monsters? Is it that kind
of?
Yeah,
I can show you pictures of parasites, and you'll be like, oh man. I mean, there might be microscopic ones, but they look. I mean, if they were 10 times as big, you'd be like, gee, you know. I mean, some of them you look at now, like bed bugs and stuff. They're scary looking things.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just the variety as well. You know, you've got schistosomiasis and, you know, the gap year disease everyone comes back with after having swum in various lakes.
All right.
Or giardia as well, you know, the one that basically gives you the stinkiest poos known to man sort of thing. So that kind of, you know, it's all these things. It was just the wide variety. And I feel like compared to other pathogens, so like I said, with viruses or, you know, even one of the things we even studied there was like bot flies. So, you know, the ones that burrow into the skin,
parasites
as well. Or we even went to the London, I think it was the Natural History Museum, I think it was, where we had a talk about decomposition and bodies and what flies and bugs go in at certain times and how forensics get involved with that sort of thing. So that was like, oh, wow, you know. So every single day was something interesting.
Yeah.
And also it was quite relevant as well, because we did lots of scenarios, and one of them was, oh, there's going to be, so you were a group and you had to work together, and you were sort of seen as government. And you were given a scenario that there was an outbreak somewhere in the world, somewhere like Guinea or something like that, you know, somewhere with where it wasn't quite as, you know, the news wasn't getting through, and then it started to spread. And what would you do? Who would you approach? And so it was a pandemic play out, basically. So it was quite interesting doing those side of things as well, especially with everything that's gone on in the last couple of years. But I can definitely say that the lack of Jaffa cakes in our government probably contributed to them. I think that was the winning formula for us getting through that.
The humble Jaffa cake saving lives. It's like the parasite that becomes the tongue of the fish. You know, is that a parasite? Is that that thing that gets in the fish?
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah. So I don't know what that's called, but yeah. So that's the other thing is the animal world of parasites as well.
Mm.
That's the other interesting thing. And then you've got the kind of mythological parasites too, like the kandaroo. You know the kandaroo?
No.
I might not be pronouncing that right, but it's the fish that would supposedly swim up your pee stream and into the mountains. Yeah.
Is that not real? Because that keeps me awake at night.
I've done like most people who do serious research. I've done some googling, and it doesn't. I think it's slightly more mythological, and I think some people have tried to look into it as to whether they would have the propulsion to be able to get up. So I think the jury's still out on it. But there might be ways they get in some other way anyway. But
yeah.
It's always been a story. But I have to say, like, years ago I heard about this. Like, the fish that would swim up.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's gone through old wives' tales and it's just like, oh, yeah, you know, we've got to be careful. Because I think, you know, when you're a kid and, like, you know, if you pee into a stream, you're like, oh, my goodness, there might be parasites in there. So
that was what it was. And suddenly now, when you just said that, you go, oh, yeah, how would it get up if the stream's coming out? That's quite powerful. How's it going to... It'd have to have some strength to push itself up and into you.
Well, did you see the recent Planet Earth with David Attenborough? Don't you know him? He's a national treasure.
Yeah, I've heard of him. Yeah, vaguely.
save me, I'm a national treasure. He did there was a part in it about fish which would spit on leaves and knock off insects into the water which were then eating. But then there was another one where they would swim out and jet up to the leaf and just grab it, so it would just sort of slam dunk down onto it. So it does make you think that if they got enough of a run underwater before they exited the water, they might have the propulsion.
maybe. But then you're dealing with the power of the urine coming out, which I guess on a microscopic level would be the equivalent of us trying to swim up Niagara Falls.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends how your flow rate is, isn't it? So I guess if you haven't got the flow rate. Anyway, this episode is going to change people from getting their prostates checked to seeing if they've got a fish swimming up.
Always get, if you can, check your prostate, lads. Always make sure you've got a good stream.
And if your prostate is fine, then check if there's a fish in there. That's the other thing.
Yeah, if your prostate is fine, yeah, check if there's a fish up there. This is the thing. This is all these conversations go towards helping us with our mental health, like something like that. Like every time I've been near a river or I've been in a river, I've always been like, oh, there's that thing that swims up your willy.
Exactly. <yeah. laughs> and they seek it out. Like they just assume that when you get in, there's some sort of pheromone that goes off from the groin area, and it's suddenly all the fish who were just bottom out suddenly go like that. You know that piranha thing where they just go.
There's a willy.
It could be exactly.
Yeah. Well, I love dicks. I'm going to swim up one. Love swimming up dicks. Now this conversation means that the next time I'm in a river, I will have that thought process of there's that thing that swims up your dick, and then I'll go, but no, it doesn't, because Ed Patrick said that that's probably rubbish. So
probably rubbish. Yeah.
So now I'm fine. Now I'm like,
I hope I really hope that after this podcast, someone transcribes it. And on the Google search, when someone says, does the kangaroo do it? There's a quote from me saying, Ed Patrick says it probably doesn't. That's what I want. That is my calling.
See, everybody wants a paper published, you're going to have a quote.
a quote that will make it into the Daily Mail at some point.
Yeah. Now my mental health is now eased. So this has helped. This app actually transcribes the whole podcast. This Riverside.
Oh, right.
Yeah, AI does it. They work with AI. And so I do another podcast called Please Don't Panic, which is about B-movies and things. And we were doing it last night. And then Wellesley, who's my co-host with, sent me what AI had said. And it's brilliant. So the quote there will be a quote, Ed. It's going to be out in the ether. It's going to be out.
And it's going to be misspelled, and it's going to implicate and say something else.
Yeah,
it's going to take a mixture of what we've just spoken about, and it'll be just like cocaine, fish.
You mean cocaine, fish? Ed Patrick loves the Daily Mail.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man, but that's okay. So I feel better now. That's lovely. See, you never know with these conversations where they're going to go. You don't know what you're going to debunk. I think that might be the first thing we've had debunked on here.
Yeah, well, I hope I've got some... I hope I'm right about it anyway, but that is what I've found about it. But yeah, it goes back to saying, like, there's just so many fascinating things I found about parasites, which it's got it in there. So, and similarly, that's what I found about anesthetics as well. You know, you're using, you know, lots of strong, cool drugs. Like, I always talk about this one. I guess this sort of feeds in to the sort of tropicalness of parasites as well, is that... So we use things called muscle relaxants, which paralyze people. So they're drugs that, you know, if you or I had one right now, we wouldn't be able to move at all. We wouldn't be able to breathe, we'd be conscious.
Mm.
Yeah. So when people talk about having anesthetic awareness, there's a risk of that happening if you're having surgery that would need you to be paralyzed, but there isn't enough anesthetics. That's what people are talking about with that. So it's not. So that's the that's anesthetic side of things. But the drug itself, the story, I find brilliant. So there was a guy, I think it was the 1800s, called Charles Waterton, and he knew that surgery was having some difficulty back in the time. You know, cause we had anesthetic, but you give too much anesthetic to someone to make them not move, then they, you know, there's problems with that. You could cause, you know, ill health with that way as well.
Yeah.
So there's lots of problems going on. People weren't staying still for the operations. Surgeons were very annoyed about that. And he'd been in the forests and with indigenous tribes using arrows to catch animals. And obviously the poison on the arrows, which was curare. Ooh. So he realized that, and he took that poison. And in those days, you had to demonstrate in front of people how this works. So he got a group of people together, and he got three donkeys, and he basically said to everyone, right, look at this. This is what happens. He injected donkey one with curare, and donkey one died. And then he tied a band around the leg of donkey two, so like a tourniquet, injected the curare beneath it, and then donkey two lived. I assume everyone cheered, and then took the band off, and then donkey two died.
Right.
And then donkey three, who was shitting himself at this point, he injected with curare, paralyzed the donkey, and then somehow, I don't know how they did this, but mechanically ventilated the donkey until the curare wore off, and then donkey three lived. And that's how that drug came about. Now, every single muscle relaxant we use now is based on that poison, which I just find fascinating.
That is incredible. I love that. I love things like that. Because it's always like, who was the first person to go, actually, if you did that, then that would happen. You know, it's a conversation like, who was the first person to eat an egg? You know, it's that kind of conversation.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing we have to bear in mind is that clinical trials weren't as conscripted back then to sort of humane humanity conditions or something. No. So they, you know, they could pretty much do what they did then. So I'm not sure that he could run that experiment in 2023.
No. No. I don't think that we would have got around the donkey world. We'd be like, no, that don't go near that fella.
Yeah, it'd be a bit like me trying to pitch the study I did in China in the UK, basically.
Yeah, you want to what? Gonna collect the poo of children. What? I'm going to keep it in a fridge. Okay, what? A special fridge for the poo of people? No. Just the fridge.
The lunch fridge.
So you're not going to get another fridge? No. I just use that one. Get off me. I just things like that fascinate me. And I didn't even know that. Of course, yeah. So when you get a general anaesthetic, you'll then have to be ventilated to keep you breathing.
Sometimes. So right. Sometimes if you're having surgery that doesn't require you to... So for instance, if you're having abdominal surgery, you've got lots of muscles in there. And the surgeons would need that being paralyzed so they could get in there. Whereas if you're having something done to your finger or something less than that, then you could just give an anesthetic without using muscle relaxant. And at that right. point, you can give an anesthetic. And then what would happen is that would cause the patient to stop breathing. But at some point, the physiological response would alter and the patient will start breathing for themselves while still being anaesthetized. So you can still have that. But you would help along the way, essentially.
Yeah. Ed, this has been brilliant. I've really enjoyed this. It's been a great chat. I really enjoyed this. What are you plugging? Let's plug that. Let's do what you're plugging.
So I'm going on tour.
Yes.
Next year. So I've got, I did a show at the Edinburgh Fringe this year and it was brilliant. So I did a run at the Stand, the Newtown Theatre, and it was just so much fun.
Brilliant.
And you know what it's like, one thing leads to another. So it was that. And then that led to the tour. And as I mentioned, I've got a massive anaesthetics ball ache exam I've got to get through. So,
oh, mate.
To stop the FOMO and stop that feeling I get when I don't do comedy, I've booked a tour, which we are doing next year. It starts in February, technically. So we've got the Leicester Comedy Festival. That's on February the 11th. Brilliant. And then April and May, we go all around the country. So we go to places like Newcastle, Glasgow, Edinburgh, all the stands there. We've got Brighton Comedia. We've got the Cheltenham Everyman Theatre. We're doing Bath, the Rondo Theatre. And we're doing, I think that's most of them. We're doing like 9 or 10 dates. And then it all culminates at the Comedy Store in London on May the 6th.
Fantastic.
That'll be the final short show, yeah.
That's great, Ed. No, lovely
so
work,
buy
man.
Tickets. Please buy tickets.
I think as you heard from Ed today, it's going to be a brilliant show. It's just been a brilliant chat. You've got a book out as well.
Yeah. Yes. The book is the same name as the tour as well. So Catch Your Breath is a book. So that's out. And so if you come to the show, you will appreciate more of the book. But the show's actually a different story. So for people who have read the book, there's something for everyone. What I'm trying to say is there's 400 tickets available at the Comedy Store. So if people could make that like an A&E waiting room and pack that out, that'd be fantastic.
Excellent. And where can we find you on the socials, Ed?
You can find me. So my socials are at Palmer Patrick. So like Palmer Ham. And that is because when I was at university, there was some Palmer Ham on sale at Tesco, reduced. I bought that. But despite that reduction, it was seen as a luxury buy by my flatmate. And I was therefore known as Palmer Patrick onwards. So I've embraced it. I am Palmer Patrick at every social media you can possibly imagine.
Excellent. Excellent.
Not Blue Sky, though.
No, well, I'll send you the link. Another thing to clutter your mind with. Ed, thank you so much for joining us, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Good luck with the tour. Good luck with the exams. Good luck with everything. I'm sure that we'll get along to a show. But thank you so much. And producer Paul is there. This has been Insane in the Membrane. This has been Ed Patrick. I've been Rich Wilson. We'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.